listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Welcome to episode 255 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
This is a catch-up episode. We're going to be looking at what people have been watching, reading, playing.
Other condiments are available, by the way. It's not just ketchup.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, I mean, right. French mustard is also an option, apparently, according to my Instagram tonight.
It's also BBQ sauce.
Oh yeah, BBQ sauce. Sriracha.
This is the most tasty tangent.
Ooh, garlic mayo.
We were going to start...
Oh, garlic mayo.
But with potatoes.
Oh, man.
Okay, so we were going to start with like...
Chili sauce?
Maybe. We were going to start with the one thing that everyone on this podcast episode tonight. Oh my God.
Which is brown sauce.
Fuck's sake.
No, brown sauce, get in the bin.
What?
Oh, what? Paul is offended. Oh, Paul is aghast at this. Aghast.
Oh my.
Okay. So we're going to start with something that everybody has watched, which would be Terminator Dark Fate. If you've been following movie news, it has been bombing in the box office. And quite frankly, having seen the freaking film, I believe that is undeservedly so. Discuss.
I'm so glad they finally made the third Terminator film.
Yes.
It's been a long time. I do wonder why they've waited this long.
It is an exceptionally long time, and you are right. You are right.
You know, it's... at least decent if Retroid acknowledges its existence.
Yeah.
I've said on previous podcasts that Terminator 2 came out in the cinema just as I was starting college.
Yeah.
And I ended up watching it about 5 times in the cinema.
It's fair.
So
I did that something similar with that with the first Spider-Man movie, the original. You know,
what, 5 times?
Like, at least 4, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never been to the cinema to watch the same film more than twice.
I really liked Spider-Man when it came out.
Oh, and another one just coming to mind here. I saw Ghostbusters on original release.
Oh,
and when it was re-released a year or two back.
Wait, was it re-release of it?
Terminator Dark Fate!
Yeah, in a different timeline. which this very much is, isn't it?
It's a different timeline to, everything that we've... Yeah.
Those 3 films that suddenly didn't exist.
What 3 films?
Exactly.
I mean... I can't remember Terminator Genesis that much.
I can remember it enough.
I mean, did they manage to kill Cyberdyne? Does this actually follow on, or is this like a definitely like an alternate?
It is an alternate timeline.
Nothing.
It's basically, what's Terminator Genesis? I've not heard of that. Is that some kind of weird, you know, fanfic that someone did? Because it's definitely not. Something I've seen.
You know, if I was going to rate the fanficiness of the 3 films that no longer exist, you know, I think it is
getting seriously meta here.
It's a toss up between Salvation and Genesis. Like, there's some wacky elements in both, but I feel like Salvation is probably the most fanficky because it tries to have 2 protagonists, but it doesn't know quite how to balance them, and that's because you try not to have 2 freaking protagonists in the same film. Anyway,
it's also a far worse film than Genesis, in my opinion.
Yeah. Terminator Dark Fate is it's very actiony. It has a lot of action.
Yeah.
I liked a lot of the stunt work and effects that was going on in it.
I think it's actually one of the few films that I've actually seen people being de-aged in and could actually believe it.
Yeah, there was a lack of uncanny valley for that.
Which is kind of uncanny, anyway, yeah. Because you know that, logically speaking, that has to be CG.
Yeah.
Well, what was quite nice, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it's not a spoilery to say that, you know, the first scene was, Sarah on a, you know, like, you know, in a beach cafe, and everything's great because they stopped, you know, the apocalypse and saved 3 billion lives.
From Terminator 2, if anybody's not.
From the original Judgment Day.
Yeah, from the original Judgment Day.
And then a Terminator, a T-800, arrives and kills John Connor.
Yeah.
So this Terminator is successful.
But then it's interesting because I'm not going to reveal the names and stuff, but basically the enemy for the film shifts a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit, and the focus changes. And what's interesting is that they've adapted the technological things that lead to the extinction almost level event of the future in a way that acknowledges the changes that have happened to technology in the since Facebook basically and Google becoming big. And I really, really, really appreciated that. Because, it's one thing to worry about government weapon systems, but, you know. In fact, actually, to be fair, it also makes you think you should be worried about government data systems as well in this one. Forget weapons, think data. Lots of data.
Yeah. It's the weapon is data, and it's kind of like you have a parallel evolution where you have completely unrelated things end up at a very similar endpoint, like ichthyosaurs, which look a lot like dolphins, or you know, they did, you know, about, you know, several hundred million years ago, and of course, you know, they look similar, but they're completely unrelated. Whereas it seems in this case, the apocalypse and the Terminators still happen, but they are different.
Yeah, and that's good.
That's a good thing. I have no issue with, you know, because it and also, you know, the whole timeline thing, you can, you know, just tidily, if you change it, then, you know, the whole series was about changing timelines.
Yeah.
So there's no issue there.
Yeah. I have to admit, though, with this new timeline, the one thing I do, because there was a lot I hated about the third film that doesn't exist. I kind of liked how it ended.
That was the one positive about three.
Yeah, and I kind of wished that they had done a proper initial, like we've never had an initial days film, like an initial event film. Like which is frustrating because it's kind of like you show us snippets, but you never really go into what it was. Like, I mean, actually, this new one does a bit, but still not as much as stuff
could. It's probably got the most of the future content in, you know, any of them that we've seen. Apart from Sarah Connor, the Sarah Connor Chronicles, the TV series, which was actually quite good.
Isn't Salvation set in the future, though?
Yeah, but it doesn't exist anymore, thankfully, so we don't have to bother. Yeah. It you know, the whole thing was just...
It was an alternate timeline.
But yeah, so bring this back to my initial point. I think that Dark Fate's done badly in the box office is not a testament to the quality of the film.
No, it really isn't.
It's a testament to its previous... it's crap that it's been lumbered with.
And can I just say that I kind of hate how, you know, kind of they've been turn around and saying that, oh, you know, it's not been doing well at the box office and whatnot. And it's kind of making it a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, because people are less likely to see it if they feel like it's actually done badly.
Well, yeah, it's like it's also like it was it's social confirmation type stuff, you know. So
I have seen a few examples of that in even you know just people taking the piss where it's oh I really liked thing X, but then my favorite YouTuber spent. You know, over 2 hours explaining how it was trash. So now I must inform myself it is trash. I'm not allowed to like this thing. And that's always been a kind of a, you know, thing that's gone on. I've also seen a few, oh, it's because it's got too many women in. And it's bollocks. It's because it had a series of shit films with diminishing returns each time. So it was, oh, God, they're doing another Terminator film. Why should we bother when the last three have been either bad or awful?
And you know what? I feel like the marketing still could have been better as well. I don't think did enough of the marketing. I think they took the wrong emphasis with the trailers. They didn't do enough in the trailers to mark it out from the other films, other than the fact that we had characters that we didn't expect to see.
Yeah, I think... I think if in the trailer they actually had the opening bit, that would actually have turned around and said to, you know, basically the viewers that something's very, very different here. This does not follow on from those three non-existent films. This leads on straight from Terminator 2.
Yeah.
And then I think people would have actually been like, oh, really?
What they could have done is... you know, some flashes of, you know, the first Terminator and Terminator, you know, T2.
Mm. Yeah.
And then go right onto this with no reference to the other films. Because if they'd got James Cameron coming on, you know, with the cast and just say, you know, you can ignore those. You know, the one that you think's really good, you know, the one that you bought probably about three times. This is a sequel to that. You know, that one where, you know, you kind of went to see because it was Terminator and you walked out of the cinema grumbling. That doesn't exist anymore. We've done you a favor. Mm-hmm. You can ignore that. In fact, you can burn that now. If you bought that or someone's bought it for you, you can burn it. It doesn't matter. And there would have been much rejoicing.
Yeah. Okay.
Because, yeah, it's just, I am going to be very angry if it's not a hit on, you know, Blu-ray and streaming.
Hmm. Yeah,
because you know there's historical basis for that, where you know a film has you know done really badly at the cinema, but as soon as it hits you know rental and you know home release, you know streaming is probably going to be the you know the version of rental now, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
But you know it could make up its money, and I really hope it does, because
I mean that's kind of like what happened with Dread. I mean, they mismarketed it in the American market, where 2000 AD doesn't have as good a presence as a brand, and like the international market liked it a bit more than the British market. And then it was on home release, and that it did well.
Mm.
But unfortunately, the damage had already been done, and we wouldn't get a sequel.
Yeah, unfortunately, the money men see the numbers in the cinema as the ones which are important.
Which is crazy, because like ticket returns in general across cinema is something that is not doing as well as it could.
Yeah, I mean there's a lot of different factors involved in you know cinema ticket sales.
Yeah,
it's not just a case of isn't a good film, therefore it won't sell.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean we have unfortunately seen that kind of crap before, where you have the people who are in charge of you know making all these big decisions. And they'll see the TV ratings or whatever, and they'll completely miss the fact that that's, you know, the first evening or, you know, like opening weekend is no longer really the most important thing.
No.
You can get a hell of a lot of money later on in the process where they're, you know, usually used to thinking, yeah, you know, let's just mop up what we can. And that's where, you know, some things have really shone. So I'm still hopeful. I know it's done badly in the cinema, but
Yeah.
It deserves so much better.
Yeah. And now I'm going to move on to another film which Paul and I have watched. I'm sure people remember from like a few months back me reading Doctor Sleep, where we had the opportunity to go see the film adaptation when it was released. You need to have watched The Shining, but you can't get away from it. So if you haven't seen the film of The Shining, you do have to have seen it before you see Dr. Sleep. And I say film rather than read the novel, because the film Dr. Sleep follows the canon of the film of The Shining rather than the book. Okay, I got that out of the way.
That's because surely that shouldn't be a problem, but you never know, do you?
Yeah, you'd think, but it does bear mentioning, partly because Kubrick's film wasn't actually well liked by King anyway. But really enjoyed Doctor Sleep. Again, something that hasn't been doing as well as it could at the box office. Mm. It's actually a pretty suspenseful film, scary in the right places. It has a lot going for it. They did basically a really good job of figuring out how to attach it to the how to turn the novel to make sure it followed the canon of the film of The Shining, rather than, because obviously the novel followed the canon of the novel. So they managed to adapt that element of the canon very well. They managed to figure out kind of like bits that were a bit maybe fluffy in the novel, in terms of they didn't necessarily have to be there, and kind of tightened elements of the plot a bit that King as an author had like obviously time to play around with, but with a film you can't really, so they kind of trimmed the fat off a bit, made a bit leaner. It is a long film, but quite frankly I loved it. It was a far superior film to what we got treated earlier this year with the remake of Pet Sematary, deeply disappointed by. Dr. Sleep was very true to the novel whilst understanding what to change, how to change it in order to make everything kind of fit. I really enjoyed it.
It kind of reminded me of the way that Watchmen, of a TV series, which we've started watching a little bit of, and kind of trying to figure out whether it follows the original story, i.e. the comics, or whether it actually follows on from the film. And I kind of felt a little like Dr. Sleep had the same issue with that, but it kind of, as Emily suggested, it kind of more takes on from the film rather than the original novel. And so far with Watchmen, I think one of the...
So we were switching to Watchmen now.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
With Watchmen.
Yeah, because it was...
Yeah. I found that... I don't want to give too much away, but it follows more on from the comics... mostly because of the squid.
There's a squid situation. Multiple squids, in fact.
Yeah, which obviously follow on from the comic books rather than the film. And I was kind of a bit disappointed in that, because it's like, I think that people who watch, you know, Watchmen, the TV series, would most likely be familiar with the film rather than the comic book. And the film... it seems better to have Doc Manhattan as the, you know, the patsy, as it were, rather than having that giant squid, which seems like, I mean, Doc Manhattan is pretty much like all powerful in terms of, like, you know, can kind of see multiple paths through time and, you know, kind of do all these weird and wacky wonderful things. And people believe that with Doc Manhattan around, that the squid thing would still work?
Well, it is in the original storyline, so, you know, I like that. And Yeah, I know people who absolutely hate the film, whereas I don't quite like the film. But so yeah, I know what you're saying with that. But I'm just waiting until I can binge the whole thing.
Fair.
I was also thinking of rereading my graphic novel.
Good idea.
Because it's never a bad time to reread Watchmen.
Well, it's kind of, well, I mean, it's kind of to be expected at this point that Alan Moore would distance himself from it, because that's Alan Moore. He will distance himself away from any, you know, kind of
adaptation.
Yeah, adaptation of his work.
So yeah. Okay, so Paul, what's something you've been up to?
Retroid or Paul?
Sorry, Retroid.
Well, I've been War of the Worlds-ing.
Which one? This is the thing.
Yes. Yes is the answer.
All of the things.
Well, as an example, we found out that, you know, of course, the BBC adaptation, you know, was part one was on last week. But it had been on in Canada, I think, already.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. But it's a little bit weird to watch something from the BBC and then have an excited Canadian adverts at the end. But yeah, so watch that. Although not before we accidentally, you know, Dave Internet being a little bit, you know, confusing, you know, sometimes, or, you know, confused, bless him. Just looked for War of the Worlds and, you know, got several episodes, and it's like, okay, sat down and watched it. Hang on, part of this is in French. That's a bit weird. Check it. It's a Canal Plus and Fox, you know, TV co-production, which is going to be on, you know, later in the year over here, or possibly early next year, because we're quite late in the year now, aren't we?
Yeah.
Is that the
Fox one, which is set in America?
And also France.
Okay, The Fox one, because we've seen trailers for it on Now TV.
Mm.
For the Fox channel, obviously. So I think it's I think it's coming this side of Christmas.
I thought it probably would, but don't really watch many Sky channels, so I hadn't seen. Because, you know, I thought, oh, Fox, it's going to be on TV here very shortly. It's just how these things work. But, yeah. So that one. What have the trailers shown?
Not much, really, other than the fact that it's like modern set and something weird's happening. And, oh, look, it's called War of the Worlds with very red lettering. Modern, red, blocky lettering. But that's the thing.
Gerdemond.
I mean, Fed, that's kind of obviously like Fox on the Now TV and on Sky, you know, it's got a very blocky design anyway. And I think the font thing is more to do with the way that they show names for stuff.
Fair enough.
So.
Let's see. Would it be okay to say more or less what happens in the first episode?
Oh, the BBC one or the Fox one?
The Fox one, because Fox this one. Is the one we saw first. They get a message, or, you know, they detect something going on. There's possibly something arriving from a nearby star system, which they had previously detected an exoplanet in.
Right.
They had, you know, beamed messages to it, but of course they presumed it was going to be, you know, a very long time before, you know, they got anything back. But it turns out that they're not getting a message back. There's something coming. There are, you know, various, well, you know, what's going on, and, you know, it's on the news about it, blah, blah, blah. And it's not so much that something lands as such. It's they start getting transmissions. And one of the characters, played by Gabriel Byrnes, of you know, of all people, is a neurosurgeon, and he's talking, you know, about, oh, you know, this is how you disrupt, you know, human neurology, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, some people seem to be able to sense the transmission. Most, you know, other people can't, but you know, a few people are noticing that, you know, there's something going on. Like there's a French military base with a semi-international, you know, staff who are, you know, monitoring all this, you know, for the governments. And you know, there's something a bit weird going on. And then there's a pulse. And do you want the spoiler for the first episode?
Yeah, okay.
Billions die instantaneously.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, okay.
So you instantly have, it's a little bit like Day of the Triffids.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, people are, oh, what, you know, what's going on? Is something coming? And then next thing you know, the world has gone to hell because most people are dead or, you know, dying.
Wow. Okay.
So you have most of the first season following, you know, several survivors, some of whom, just because they happened to be in a shielded location. Others seem to have survived through, you know, some other process. And they're, you know, there are people just trying to get back to their family. There's, you know, the UK government in there. It's, everything is perfectly fine. But we're all going in this massive underground bunker.
Oh, wow.
Don't bring your families here because you'll be, you know, you'll be fine. It will be safer at home, but we're going in here. Yeah.
Delightful.
Yeah, so...
Mind you, can I just interject with something that I started reading the other week?
Sure.
Considering our political leaders and the nature of them, I found an article from September from, I think it was the Indy 100, that looked at... an entrance question for Eton. That basically said, oh yeah, like how would you respond to the media?
I believe I've heard about this.
Yeah, respond to the media of like a whole bunch of protesters basically died under like martial law because of something. And it was just like, oh wow, yeah, no, like them all going in a bunker and leaving everyone else to die is like a perfectly believable scenario based on just shit like that being real. So, I mean, that question was from 2011, but I don't think they've changed their style of entrance and philosophy of teaching in that time.
Yeah, not really. Especially because they don't seem to have changed their opinion to the commoners and the proles, do they?
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I just had to just interject with how real the bunker situation is, unfortunately.
Yeah. So you have a family who are trying to, you know, get back home in London. You have a family, well, a woman looking for her sister in France. The woman concerned who's looking for her sister is a scientist in a French military base. So she has the advantage that there are soldiers nearby who, yeah, you know that she's someone important to, you know, protect. And you have things going on, and I'm not going to spoil it, but if you're sitting down to watch War of the Worlds for, you know, alien killing machines, like, you know, tripods wandering around, the BBC one is the one to, you know, watch for that. You're not really going to get that at all in the, you know, there is a threat, I will say that, but it's not one that is really, you know, discussed.
Okay, and it's not like hyper visible, other than the after effect.
It's more sort of you don't know, until it's possibly too late, and you know, by that point you're shitting yourself because these things are not good. But they're not they're not like tripods.
Mm.
And they're not they're not like, alien soldiers or anything like that. There is something of foreign alien origin, but I will leave it at that, because I think they're introduced in something like episode 2, where some of the soldiers try to get to a local supermarket because there's, they're up high in the mountains in, snuck up mountains, and there's like a ski resort below.
Yeah.
So they go into the town below to, scout for survivors and just see what the hell, is going on. And they encounter what is, it seems to be around to mop up the survivors of the, the neural blast.
Ooh, okay.
So, yeah, I think they're quite good, but they're definitely not what you would call tripods.
Yeah.
We go on to the BBC one. You've watched the first part.
We have not watched the first part.
You have not watched the first part?
No.
Okay.
I want to point out right now that I'm slightly put off by War of the Worlds due to a game that I had to review years ago.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember. I am not the biggest fan. I have been traumatized by that game.
It was quite bad from what I remember reading.
I can't remember who published it, but it was for those listening, it was a platformer that I tried playing on 360, and it wanted pixel perfect moves for a lot of stuff, and had sluggish controls that were like maybe part of the design, but considering it wanted pixel perfect execution, not okay.
Yeah, no.
So, yeah, no.
No. Right. Well, what to say about the BBC one, other than I was really looking forward to it because the BBC have been, getting a little bit more canny with their co-productions. And they've realised that, hey, if you throw money at something so it doesn't look shit, people don't think it's shit.
And they'll watch it.
Yeah.
It's a funny story,
we were both disappointed because my wife and I, are big fans of, several War of the Worlds things, not the 360 game, so you don't have to worry there. We watched it, and they made some changes to, say, the pods that the Martians arrive in.
Mm.
And I'm not entirely sure why they've done that, other than it, maybe it's a little bit more spectacular to have it, have something happen before the tripods. The tripods themselves look fine, but you don't get to see them anywhere near as much as you would think. Other than there's a beach evacuation scene in the second half, I think that the main problem I have with it is a massive lack of scale.
As in what scale? Like, what objects or parts of scenery, characters, environment?
Scope, really.
Okay.
Because H.G. Wells, famously, disliked Empire.
Yeah.
So he struck upon the idea of the world's greatest empire, which at the time was the British Empire. At the height of its power, and arguably at the height of its arrogance,
mm-hmm.
suddenly facing a completely new enemy, which absolutely outmatched it in every single way.
Yeah.
So, that is a good basis for, a book or any TV series, film, anything like that. And now, the problem I get with this is that first of all, it shows the alien machines in a small English village, which is not an issue, so long as you then ramp it up after that when, you know, the army starts to realize that it's up against something which is, you know, seriously just kicking its ass. Not so much, you know, handing their asses back to them, but handing their asses back to them and then vaporizing them. So you've got the, you know, the British Empire, the British Army. You see a few soldiers and a few guns. There are a few battleships in the, you know, the beach evacuation scene where they're, you know, trying to, you know, stop the Martian killing machines while they get their people off the beach.
Yeah.
And that's about as close to, you know, a sense of, you know, epic sense of scale that you get. Because apart from that, you know, like London gets attacked, but do you see massive scenes of, you know, the machines walking through, you know, British landmarks, you know, London landmarks? No, you do not. Do you see famous, you know, buildings being obliterated as you would expect to see in, you know, something like this?
You don't.
No, yeah, you do not. And in fact, the only way that these, you know, the sense of scale and the original bloody idea of that H.G. Wells had about, you know, maybe, you know, this is what the Empire has been doing to its enemies, and it's, you know, it's kind of a karma thing that, you know, there's always going to be a bigger bully. That is left to a conversation in the second half between two characters.
Weird.
It's also got I hate it when episodes do, you know, if you have the, you know, the flash forward and flashback trope in several series, and I find it difficult to think of a good episode of any TV series I've watched where they keep flashing forward and then they say, you know, oh, like, you know, several years earlier, or, you know, like, half an hour earlier, and it's just, why not just, unless you're going to be revealing things that, you know, you can only reveal and the entire narrative hangs on that flipping back and forth, why do it?
Yeah.
And the BBC War of the Worlds does that constantly throughout. And it's very easy to tell, because then, you know, you have sequences where you're obviously on an Earth which is ruined and it's covered in the red weed. And, you know, people are, you know, starving because, you know, the crops are failing because of the red weed.
Yeah.
And it's raised that, you know, perhaps this is, you know, this is what they intended. We didn't win. Maybe this was just, you know, they sent them here to play, you know, to plant the red weed, and then they can just wait. So, you know, there's that, but I don't understand why you would, you know, flash back and forth like that, other than, you know, for people who have never seen War of the Worlds or never heard about War of the Worlds and maybe just want a, well, it, you know, Earth does win, air quotes around it.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand why, you know, they've done it like that. But yeah, to give an idea of how much we thought of that, you know, of the BBC series, we watched the second episode, and then the next chance we got, we watched the 1953 American film. Have you ever seen?
No.
Ah.
I don't think I have.
Did you say 1953 American one?
The 1953 American film, yes. It's the famous one where you've got the alien ships where that, you know, they don't have legs, because it's 1953. How the hell are they going to do, you know, three legs? But, you know, considering when it was made, they, you know, they have remarkably good special effects. And that is an example where you have the film. The film is about 5 minutes shorter than either half of the BBC adaptation. And yet, it does a much better job of the escalation of, you know, the fight against the Martians and the complete hopelessness and the desolation that they leave behind. It is 1950. I mean, it's in color, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, if you've never seen it, or it's been a while since you've seen it, I do recommend, you know, tracking down a copy. It is still on DVD, and it recently got remastered for Blu-ray. So it is, you know, regarded as a sci-fi classic. And in the context of, you know, an empire at its height, it picks America, you know, at a good moment because, of course, you know, it's 1953. So, you know, they've just had the Second World War and there's no, you know, like Vietnam or Korea in the, on the horizon. So, you know, there's no, you know, like quagmire. So far as the Americans are concerned, you know, they're the all-powerful, you know, righteous empire, for want of a better term when it comes to empire. But, yeah, and of course, you know, the aliens land, they very quickly, you know, show themselves to be dangerous, and the American military is, well, you know, we'll just send all our troops. Oh, that doesn't work. We'll nuke them. Oh, that doesn't work. Right, we'd best evacuate the cities then. And, yeah, it packs a hell of a lot more wallop than the BBC in less than half the time.
Okay. And then I'll
just say that we also listened to Jeff Wynne's War of the Worlds musical.
Okay.
Which is still ace.
Okay. We just remembered that there was a third film we've seen in the cinema.
Oh my God.
We saw, it's not technically called that, it's Zombieland Double Tap. Is it Double Tap?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's Double Tap.
So Zombieland 2, the long-awaited sequel to Zombieland. Now, if we can just get Tucker and Dale versus Evil 2, it will be well set. But Zombieland 2.
Yeah, I mean, it's... what can you say about that? I think it has a lot of the kind of goofiness of the original. A lot of moments of, like, they did that. Okay. Obviously, it follows on from the original with, you know, Jesse Eisenberg and Woody Harrelson, Emma Stone. And includes actually some other fairly big names as well. But I will say that at the end, there is like a...
post-credit scene.
Yeah.
Or a partway through credit scene. Yeah. Either way, you should stay and watch it.
Yes, yes.
Does it manage to live up to the original?
I think it's a little bit weaker, because I feel like they kind of relied a little bit too much on repeating some of what was established in the original, but then there's elements that they managed to try and evolve and turn around a bit to create humor, especially the rules.
Mm.
There's a whole shtick about the rules and kind of like and basically kind of comes into play. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's really difficult to kind of explain without spoiling it, but it's definitely has the same feel as the first one. I think generally tends to have more survivors than the first one.
Yeah, I suppose more people. Yeah, actually, in comparison, yeah, there was.
But there's also more
bigger,
danger.
There's more danger. Bigger living body count. But obviously, they kind of acknowledge that time has passed.
Yeah.
Since the original. Is it as much as the actual timing of?
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
Not as, you know, long. So I mean, it's been blooming like 7-8 years or something like that since the original.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been quite that long.
Yeah.
I feel. But it has been a couple of years now.
It was a funny film. There are bits where. There's one particular character where something happened to them that was like, I don't think that's what they thought happened to it. And, yeah. I've tried not to spoil.
I'm just wondering who you're referring to in that one. Oh, wait. Yes, yeah.
I've just done, for Paul's benefit, I have just done an impersonation of that character in such a way that it was completely silent, but yet managed to convey perfectly who that character was.
Yes.
So I think
it was pretty good. It kind of dealt with
a bit like The Walking Dead, how it was more about like the people and the settings rather than like surviving the zombie apocalypse in a way.
But at the same time, the zombies are still a big issue.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes.
A very present and big issue.
Yes.
I'm going to move us on I'm going to move us shuffling on into The Walking Dead, because I think everyone's been keeping up with that.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So, how many episodes into season 10 are we now?
I think, was it around 8? Or 9, maybe?
I thought it was about 6.
All right. I'm not 100% sure.
We're at least 6 episodes in.
Yeah.
It is a number.
Yes, it is a number.
Yeah.
Oh, this... the okay, so the episode that aired in the UK this week...
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that coming until just before it happened at the end.
Mm, yes, yes. Mm. And that was kind of frustrating because, you know, that was a character that I'd liked and it was just like, oh, shit.
But also, I think they've really tried to go out of the way so far this season to show the, is it the Whisperers?
Yes.
And Alpha and all that as very different foes to who they faced before. Like, it's not just the whole...
It's not just their survival tactics.
Yeah.
It's their battle tactics.
I mean, it's certainly... It's perhaps... was interesting, maybe reminiscent of ideas around how ninjas fight and also, like, ideas from, like, how the Viet Cong dealt with American troops during the Vietnam War. There's similarities in terms of the tactics and that, which is interesting. And you obviously, like, the Viet Cong didn't have zombies, but there's basically sort of guerrilla warfare kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, infiltration.
Are we kind of assuming that there's a certain level that the audience will know in terms of, like, the overall storyline of Walking Dead? Because, you know, I kind of want to sort of, like, say that Alpha, which is the leader of the Whisperers, has an incredibly different feel to her than any of the main bad guys that you've had before. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's I'm looking forward to her getting killed far more than I did Negan. Negan was he was a bastard, but he was kind of a bit of a funny bastard.
Is it because she's female or just because of the tactics?
I think it's because of the tactics and how creepy she is.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, because Negan was a bastard. But
yes.
He clearly, you know, demonstrated over the arc that, yeah, he's a bastard, but far less of a bastard and, you know, than several under his command.
Yeah, I mean, say, for example, his situation with Carl, you know, and his, you know, he kind of, not quite a surrogate father for him because, you know, Rick was around at the time, but, you know, he was actually fond of Carl.
Mm.
And, you know, even like with, like, the governor in the past and stuff like that, and it's been like, you know, there were certain characters that got on with him and could kind of see eye to eye with him. No pun intended on that one. But yeah, in terms of, like, you know, sort of like this series of The Walking Dead and like Alpha, it's like I'm kind of looking forward to her demise.
I'm going to move us on to one thing I've been up to, if that's all right.
Just one.
Just the one from it. I don't think we're going to get through the full list.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
But I picked up, because I seem to be having quite the Stephen King year, I picked up Sleeping Beauties, which he co-wrote with Owen King. It came out originally in, 2017. I've got the paperback version, which came out last year. It's like 700-odd pages long. It's chunky, chunky novel. I find it really interesting. I think I'm about halfway through now. I've had it for a couple of weeks. It's basically, imagine if you will, one after one night worldwide, women and girls and baby girls, they don't wake up from sleep. Instead, they're covered in this weird, gauzy web-like substance. And if you disturb that substance that's covering their faces and it slowly covers their entire bodies, you will have a rabid, crazy person on your hands. He will try to kill you. So basically, it kind of looks at that. That's the basis of the story. Like, we slowly learn the origins of it a bit. And kind of it follows the people of a particular town.
Yeah.
And some of their connections with the outside world, but mostly the people in a specific town, which is based in the Appalachians. Is it Appalachians or Appalachian? Is this the Appalachian Mountains?
I think it's Appalachian.
So Appalachian Mountains. It's really interesting. It's not that everyone, like all the women, fell asleep at the same time. Basically, the whole thing, it follows the time zones.
Yeah.
So like the first reported cases were women who didn't wake up in like Australia, and then it just kind of, you know, slowly cycles through the world. I think it was kind of going and you know, like hits like the West Coast before it hits the East Coast. But yeah, and you've got like women characters, you're like trying not to fall asleep and stuff. Huge chunk of the story settles around a women's prison that's part of the town. It's just, there's some really good character stuff going on it, and some real sort of like mystery and creepiness. I think there might have been a dig. There was a reference to Dean Koontz at one point, which was quite nice. I haven't finished it yet. I'm like halfway through, but I'm just seriously enjoying it. It's worth checking out if you want something long. What's also interesting is this is like the second book, novel that Stephen King's been involved with that I've read that has basically a whole thing about sleep. Like, he's really got a thing about sleep, I think, at this point, because the first novel I wrote, read, that King had done that basically had a heavy theme around sleep was Insomnia. Yeah. Also a long novel, perhaps longer, but not by much. It is an interesting, that Sleep and Beauty is, again, like Insomnia, is an interesting investigation around the concept of sleep and dreams and stuff. So yeah, I think we can
I suppose once you're banging around loads of ideas on one topic like that, you come up with all kinds of things that don't necessarily fit in one.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's co-written with Owen King as well. I think we can have one more thing. I think it's gonna have to be Paul. Pick a thing.
Which Paul?
This Paul. Sit beside me, Paul.
Okay. Right, okay, so I think probably go with Atypical.
Oh, the Netflix series.
Yes, which is a series about a family whose son is on the autistic spectrum, and basically how it affects their kind of day-to-day lives and their relationships with each other and relationships to the outside world and kind of growing up and stuff. It's on Netflix. It's got three seasons already. We've been pretty much binge watching it, as you know, the series to watch at the moment. I just kind of like the representation of that they've kind of built of, you know, autism in general, and kind of dealing with people reacting to that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's incredibly thoughtful, like the way it considers its subject matter. And it it's surprising that the heroes, as it were, that do emerge that aren't just sort of like a main character, because you've got Sam, he's the kid who's got autism spectrum disorder, and like, so you kind of center around him, but then it is all his friends and support network that then it kind of like flows around as well. But I think it does a nice balance, because it kind of doesn't focus like too much on anyone.
Yeah,
and it actually does a good amount of a good level of hopping,
and it's actually a fairly positive representation of somebody with on the spectrum. Say for example, in general, in media, people that are on the spectrum or people that have disabilities, whether physical or mental, they are often presumed to be pretty much asexual. Whereas Sam is, obviously not necessarily a horn dog, as it were, but he does have an interest in dating and in sex, just not in the same way and with different perspectives than neurotypical people.
Yeah, it's really nice.
And he has a best friend that he works with that you'd think, he would.
They would clash completely.
Yes, because he, as like a main character, is pretty much like a kind of a bit of a hound dog.
Yeah.
In a way, always after the ladies, always got, dating advice that's kind of, not particularly fantastic and whatnot. But the way that he deals with Sam is incredibly understanding.
Mm.
He's always kind of willing to, kind of step out of, anything and give him basically what he needs, and it's kind of refreshing for Sam to actually have that level of
awareness from somebody who isn't a family member.
But it's and the sister that's obviously got her own stuff going on as well, but she's not like mollycoddling Sam. She's a bit of like even though she's like a little sister, not little by that much, so only like 1 or 2 years. 2 years, as Emily's pointing out at me at the moment. And, there is a lot of friction between the two characters, but you do genuinely get this sense that they, that she cares for him.
Yeah.
Then the mother that's kind of learning or trying to learn to stop being so overbearing with him, and the father that's actually trying to kind of connect more with him.
Yeah.
And it's kind of nice to see those relationships, kind of grow and not just be like very, very static and, being like, not necessarily ultra supportive, but, supportive in, I suppose, typical ways.
Yeah. But I suppose one thing to note is that genre-wise, I'm not sure where it quite fits, because it's kind of comedy, but then not.
Yeah.
Because it does, like, there are funny elements in it, but then, like, it does take itself seriously at the same time.
Mm. Yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of a comedy show with a lot of heart, but it's mostly drama. And, it's kind of an interesting one.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, other than drama and maybe like a bit of dark comedy every now and again, I couldn't probably place my finger on its exact genre.
Yeah.
But it's, a positive representation of, autism in general anyway.
Okay. I have to say, though, I think this is all we've got time for this week.
Yes, we better go before Emily actually falls asleep on us.
Unfortunately, this is currently my eyes are not dealing well with staying open. So it is good night from...
It's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm on Eurogamer as Retroid and Super Retroid on Twitter.com.
It's good night for me, Paul Blewitton. I'm on Twitter as @PaulBlewitt.
And it's good night for me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter at EMKingMA. You can find notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever the heck it is, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Casts and I think maybe a couple other places. You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. We're also on Facebook as Nerds Assemble Podcast. So yeah, that's all we've got time for. So good night.
Good night.
Good night. I forgot how to sign off. No one noticed. Martians are slightly West Country.